All right, so first off, where are my van people? People riding the van up from the ranch? Right on. Okay, so this story is mainly for you guys. Okay? Because checking yourself in to rehab. Oh, and I don't know if anybody knows, I work in profanity, how other people use like oil and stone, so I'm going to say some foul words, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but I do. That's just how I fucking talk, so sorry. But the first thing that you need to understand is that checking yourself into rehab is the hardest goddamn thing you will ever do. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm not going to candy coat it. I'm not going to lie to you. It's hard. And when you come into this office here, and you're like, if you're like me, you were still high when you rolled into these doors and you're like, I think I need to go to rehab. And they're like, yeah, we think so. Right? And you take that little drive out there to the ranch and you're like, we're steep, but we're still going. There's nobody out here. The hell have I gotten myself into? Right? So you make that drive out there, and you have no idea what to expect. I had somewhat of an idea, but it's very terrifying and humbling because you don't know what's going to happen to you. But I can honestly say this. If you listen to what they have to say, and you do what they tell you to do, just like Nina said, if it can get through to me, it can get through to anybody. If it can help me, it can help anybody. And so to explain that, now I will tell you my story, or attempt to. So I grew up in the armpit of the universe called Joaquin, Texas, which is this shitty little town right on the border with Louisiana. The population, conveniently, is 911 people. That should have been a warning that it's 911. Because time stopped there in 1938. You think I'm kidding? There was a section in town where the African Americans, black people live, is called the Quarters. I'm not making this shit up. Backwoods doesn't begin to cover it. Ignorance is actually celebrated. What, you think I'm joking? I'm not. There's a town full of Trump voters in there. I can just promise you that. Oops, sorry, didn't mean to get political. So anyways, people would often ask me, they would say, well, Joe, what did you do in small town East Texas? And I said, easy, we drank and we left town. Right? Because there wasn't that much to do. Oh, and 30 miles across the border, literally grew up on the border with Louisiana. 18 miles on the other side of the Louisiana border, a little town called Mansfield, Louisiana. Mansfield, Louisiana had figured out that they made more money selling alcohol than they got from federal highway dollars. So they said, yeah, we'll take your 21 age drinking age and just not do it. So the 20th drinking age still there was 18. And I had a car and I knew where Mansfield, Louisiana was. And so at the time, in my senior year in high school, they had a drive-through liquor store right there. And it's bad when you're 18 and they know you by name. When you drive up to the thing and they're like, hey, Joe. And you're like, oh, God. What, the usual? Yeah, you know. So my drinking career began when I was, I don't know, 15, 16, somewhere around in there, for some stupid reason. And, well, because I was bored. Because there wasn't really anything else to do. I don't ever think it was really a problem, although I do identify myself as an alcoholic and an addict, mainly so that I never get any ideas that I can drink. because as a good friend of mine used to say, I know at the bottom of every bottle there's a meth pipe. Because my drug of choice is crystal methamphetamines. Snorted, smoked, not shot. I don't know if that's like a drink you serve, maybe, like a how you order it. We'll get there. So I made it through most of college. Just drinking. Pulled some really epic drinking stories, but, you know, everybody else was doing it, so it seemed like it was okay, right? No problem. Tried pot for the first time while I was in college, and that was pretty cool because, you know, everything slowed down. I have a very active mind. Like, anytime I look at somebody and I say, what are you thinking? And they say nothing, I think to myself, you lucky bastard. Because for me, I always have two or three thoughts going at the same time. And sometimes they're competing for space, and they're competing for my attention. And sometimes they're not. But the fact that I found something that allowed me to slow down and have one thought at a time was pretty cool. I like that. That was all right. Again, no big deal. In 94, I moved to Austin. And it was not too terribly long after that I discovered the rave scene, which was used to be a big deal, right? And what used to be a big deal in the rave scene was MDMA or ecstasy. And that was, as far as I was concerned, that was God's little gift. Because all of a sudden, everything that you wanted to do and whatever you were doing felt pretty fucking amazing, and you wanted to just keep doing that. And then on top of that, I discovered amphetamines. So you put those two things together, with acid occasionally, and with pot and opium every now and then, and quite a few other things, and this is a recipe for a real jacked up person. That was when I was married to my first wife. That marriage went to hell in a handbasket. Shocker. I'm not saying that drugs were involved. Drugs were involved. So then I kind of pulled myself, I don't know, a long period of time passed. I've always been real fortunate in that I was able to hold a job and be a functional drug addict, right? Because, let's face it, if there's a drug that you're going to use that's going to let you be functional at work, methamphetamines is probably the way to go. Because guess what? You're awake for days. But you're awake, right? And you're functional and you're productive. Until you aren't. Yeah, because there's always the until you aren't. Anyways, in 2006, I started working with that man right there. That becomes important here in just a second. And he was present for some of my early misadventures. And we'll just say that I wound up getting in a little legal trouble. Possession. And I wound up being sent to the SMART program. Again, thanks to that man over there. And the SMART program is state-mandated rehab. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of that, if you've ever been to it or known anybody been to it. It's 5 months at this little place, and if you're really unfortunate, you have to stay there for 5 months. I was not. I had work release. So at 5 o'clock every morning, they woke us up, and we got to go to work. And then we came back every day. And you know what? I got it. I sobered up. And I got out of the SMART program, and I was determined to do good. And so for about 2 years, I did. I was okay. Except for that whole going to meetings thing. And except for that whole getting a sponsor thing. And except for that whole, what is it they say, ISM is the ISM, and ISM stands for I sponsored myself. Yeah. So I was having a real bad week. Real bad week. And a guy I knew called me on my way home, and he said, "Hey, man, I got the fire. And if you do what I do, you know what that means." And he said, "You really ought to come over." And you know what? Because I hadn't been working a program, because I hadn't been doing what I was supposed to be doing. That sounded like a good idea. And I foolishly thought to myself, "I can handle this. It'll be fine. I'll do it once. And it'll be great." But as we all know, this disease is progressive, just like you said. It never stops. You halt it. You can shut it off for a little while. You can basically go into remission. It's like having cancer and going into remission. But I was back full blast the way I was in a matter of weeks, and things went rapidly downhill. Rapidly. I'll fast forward to through a whole bunch of misadventures, but I will say this: 2 Februaries ago. Now, 2 Februaries ago, this man met me outside of our office, and he said, "Give me your phone, and give me your office key, and I never want to see you again, and I never want to speak to you again. I don't ever want to hear from you ever again." And I deserved it. Let's see, by that time, my dad was barely talking to me. I was involved with a girl that was, her psychiatric report says she suffers from, and I quote, "a complex constellation of psychological issues which affect every area of her functioning." I just want you to let those words sink in for a little bit. Have you ever heard the phrase, "This bitch is crazy"? I'll take any crazy girl story you got, and I'll lay it next to mine, and I promise you, I will win. Because unless at any point you can say, she looked at you one point and said, "I heard about directed energy weapons, and I'm pretty sure that's what the government's trying to use to kill me, because I can feel the directed energy weapons coming through the roof and the walls. The electricity is coming through here." Top that. You know. Go ahead. Dare ya. That's the least one. Like, that's low on the crazy scale, so. So anyways, because I was crazy too, right? Like, I was out of my head. We got pregnant. And I thought to myself, I can make this work. Right? Because I'm a card-carrying member of the Codependent Club. Right? Right? Pretty much, if you're in here, you are too. I hate to break it to you. I mean, I don't want to be mean or rude or ugly or anything, but, you know, if you've ever been in a shitty relationship and you thought to yourself, I can make this work, you're codependent. Sorry. Yeah. But, so anyways, she disappeared. And by disappeared, I mean she went to California just because she heard that I'd been murdered, which was weird. Anyway, she gave birth to our son, and the whole way I found out about that is she wanders into the emergency room, and she says, "I think Austin Energy is trying to kill me with electricity." I'm not making this shit up. So, yeah, that was when the first diagnosis of, you know, psychosis came about. Again, I don't want to get this. I could go on for days about her, but this is really about me. So long story short, after Dylan was born, I really began thinking maybe it's time for me to get my act together. So I'd gone from being a successful, productive member of society with a home and a car and a good job and good friends to literally being homeless. When I checked into Austin Recovery, I had one bag full of clothes that I had collected. That was it. The days before that, I was on the street. I did a lot of couch surfing when I could. You know, I was on the couch surf circuit. And I wanted to get a tour printed of all my friends' places that I stayed at, right? They were all in the life too, right? So it wasn't really, you know, short list. But so I found myself on the street. I remember walking down Runberg Lane at like 3 a.m. one morning going, God damn it. If you ever find yourself walking down the street, walking down Runberg Lane at 3 a.m. in the morning, I'm just going to give you a hint. Your life is fucked up and you need to fucking change, because that means things have gone wrong. Right? See? Right, I'm walking down the street going, what in the... Oh, it's one of those moments where we're going to retrace the steps that led you there. So I made the phone call, right? And I called Bluebonnet Trails. I got OSAR funding. And it took a hot minute to get into AR, but I finally got into AR. I checked into AR on May the 6th, 2015, which is to the day 18 months ago. I did the program. And you know what? When I went in, all I wanted to do was just not use anymore. Like I knew there was a good chance I would do my days at AR. I would get out and I would be right back on the street again. I didn't care. I just wanted to not use anymore. Just not use anymore. Bobby was my primary counselor. Miss Bobby. Maurice, I did the musical journey with her like three times. And I remember the second time I did the musical journey with Maurice, I had that first step moment, because I have a gigantic ego, in case you haven't figured that out. And I had to have that death of ego moment, and I had no concept of what that was. But I'm sitting there after the second musical journey, and I've got this look on my face. And Maurice comes up to me, and she says, are you all right? And I said, I feel like I'm going to die. And she smiled and she patted me on the head. I'm not kidding. She patted me on the head. And she said, oh, that's just ego death. I said, is that a good thing? She said, for you? Yes. Those moments, that was my first moment, really. I'd never had a moment like that where I realized what powerlessness was. What true powerlessness was, because in my head, if I could think of my way out of something, figure out a way to keep using and it not be a problem, whew, I tried every single way there was. Guess what? They don't work. Your disease will win every time, and it will kill you. It will. I mean, it may not be directly that. It may be, you know, there's a thousand ways to die in addiction. But I got out 8 days. 8 days after I got out of AR, I was in a sober home. This man called me. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, man, I just got out of rehab. I'm getting some clothes together. He goes, what about your son? And I said, well, he's CPS. He says, do you want to be a part of your son's life? I said, yeah, I do. He said, no. Do you want to be a part of your son's life? And I said, yeah, I do. He said, why? I said, because there's nobody that can be a better father to him than I can be. He said, good, that's the right answer. He says, how many days do you have sober? 38. Awesome. When you have 60, I want you to come back to work. And I did. I've been there ever since. I'm the director of information technology for the number 4 consulting IT firm in this city. I got an extension from CPS on June the 19th. My lawyer told me when we walked in for that extension, she said, "This, you've got like 20% chance of this happening." I told my story to the judge. She granted the extension. We walked out of the courtroom. My lawyer said, "That was a miracle." That was what I like to call divine intervention. The very fact that I am standing here before you today is the direct result of direct divine intervention. I have no doubt. As a matter of fact, Dylan, I saw Dylan today. He was at my house. I have shared custody of him. That wasn't even on the table. That wasn't even possible. I have a wonderful girlfriend now. She's sober. She's never had to deal with addiction except on a professional level because she's a mental health counselor. Right? Full circle. So, I have a lot of people who ask me, they say, "How do you do it? How did you do it? How'd you make it work? What'd you do?" I don't have a big book with me. I'm not a big book thumper. I don't think pounding something like that into your head is going to work. But there they are right there. Those 12 steps right there, they will save your life. Okay? Don't get caught up in the words. Right? Like, don't relive and you're like, "Oh my God, what is this admitted to our God and to ourselves? I don't want to do all that shit." Just do it. Get a sponsor, work with a sponsor. And after a little while, what you will notice is that, do you remember when you were an addict, how it was your lifestyle? When you were in active addiction, how everything revolved around being an addict? Like, if you, like for me, I used to tell people this, if I woke up, it was a bad day. Because that means I had either stayed up too long and had fallen out, or I had run out and had fallen out. So that meant if I woke up, my day was already fucked. So that means I had to go either get more or I had to get going, right? That was my life. That was my lifestyle. That was everything. Everything revolved around that. Well, here's the good news, people. Being in recovery becomes your lifestyle. It becomes your life. I'm not going to say that it becomes easy. I'm not going to say that every now and then the little voice doesn't get back in your head that says, "Hey, I got a great idea. Oh, you're tired. Yeah, let's, I know how to fix that." But you know what? That voice gets a little quieter. Because when you do the right thing and you do the program and you do the steps, it gets easier. But the most important thing that you can do is work with other addicts. I work with other addicts. I've gone and picked them up and taken them to sober houses. I do what I can when I can, but I don't put myself in any stupid situations. I run from them. All those people that you've got on your phone right now that are still in the life, just delete those numbers. Delete them. Don't go to their houses. Don't go near them. Don't talk to them. They don't have anything good for you. They don't. Even if they were good friends, I had some good friends that I had to just sever my ties with them and exorcise them from my life like demons. Even if they weren't bad people, they're doing bad things, and I would probably have gone back to it if I started hanging around them. Do the steps. Get a sponsor. Work with other addicts. And you know what? The very last thing you need to do is forgive yourself. Because if you're like me, you fucked everything up with everybody you knew. My dad didn't even want to talk to me. 2 weeks ago, my dad was in my house meeting his grandson for the first time. Okay? Forgive yourself because it is a disease. You didn't ask for it. I'm not saying it's not your fault. I'm not saying it's not my fault. What I did was my fault, and those are my actions. But you got to let go of beating yourself up too, because that serves you no purpose, and that's just another end for your disease to make you think you need to fix. And you know what? Open yourself to these people in these rooms, because there's a lot of love and a lot of acceptance in here. And for that, I'm very grateful. My name is Joe. Thanks for listening.